97-3841W, State ex rel. Michael Hager versus Gary Martin, Sheriff Maricopa County. Mr. Getson, Assistant State Public Defender, representing Mr. Hager.
My name is Gerhard Getson, and I represent the petitioner Michael Hager. I'm an Assistant State Public Defender in the Wausau Trial Office. This case is a review of an order denying a petition for writ of habeas corpus, which was filed in the Court of Appeals. The resolution of the issues in this case are going to have a major impact on incarcerated mentally ill defendants. They're among the most vulnerable in our jails. The allegations of fact in the petition of habeas corpus are not contested. Mr. Hager was ordered to be examined on an inpatient basis to determine his competency to proceed under Wisconsin Statute 971.14. He sat in Marathon County Jail awaiting that examination for 5 months. He now argues to this court that he should be released from custody and that the underlying criminal actions for which he was to be examined should be dismissed and should be dismissed with prejudice. This should be done because the statute and the Constitution mandate it. There are limited circumstances, admittedly, where a criminal case is to be dismissed with prejudice before a jeopardy attaches, but this is clearly one of them. The statute, in this case, was enacted due to constitutional considerations. It has established a time limit that is mandatory. Violation of such a statute means that the court loses its competency to proceed. And the cases have made that clear. There is no need to go beyond this reason for dismissal in the case. But there are more bases for dismissal than just the statute. Mr. Hager was detained for an extraordinarily long and prejudicial period of time without due process. No hearing, as I indicated, was held for 5 months. No trial could be held until his competency was determined. No competency hearing could be scheduled until he was examined.
Could he have been released on bond, sir?
It's interesting in this case that there was a bond established, and it changed. There was a cash bond in July, which I count as the first time he was held from, in July of 97. And at a November hearing, that bond was changed to a co-signed bond if it was co-signed by a relative. Now, the defense attorney at the time indicated that it was quite possible a relative wouldn't sign. But what I find interesting about this situation is that the Wisconsin statute on competency provides that there shall be no bond when inpatient examination is ordered. So if the law is really followed, there should not have been a bond. It is clear in this case that my client could not meet the bond. Otherwise, he would have been.
Mr. Getson, do you think that the defense attorney here sort of went to sleep? I mean, I find it hard to believe that the attorney wouldn't have been wondering when the hearing was going to be scheduled, where the report was, especially given the kind of time frame we're talking about.
Well, that could well be, and my contention is, though, that this is not a consideration in this case, that this is a habeas corpus case, and that the cases in this state make clear that in a habeas corpus case, the only consideration in this particular circumstance is whether he was held unconstitutionally. If there was a finding made in this case, or if there was some discussion or some holding in this case concerning the actions of the defense attorney, I'm not sure that it would really relate to the proper holding in the case that surrounds constitutional and statutory issues.
Do you think there are any sanctions here that might be effective short of dismissal of the charges?
When the speedy trial, the constitutional speedy trial cases are read, for instance, Barker versus Wingo, Barker versus Wingo indicates that this amorphous right can be protected only by dismissal. So I read the speedy trial cases in that kind of situation as saying that dismissal with prejudice is the only remedy if the right has been violated.
What's the speedy trial in the state of Wisconsin? How many days? 90 days, is it?
The statutory speedy trial right in misdemeanor cases is 60 days from initial appearance, and it is 90 days from arraignment if the demand is made in felony cases.
Well, I thought... I've got two problems, I guess, and I'm not addressing the due process concerns, but I thought that there were two areas that I'd like you to address where I think your case might be a little weak. One is the availability of mandamus, and he's represented by counsel.
I'm sorry, and I didn't hear the availability.
He's got the keys to the kingdom himself, or his lawyer does, to open up the jail and to let him out. When 15 days passes, he can go to court and get the court to order to proceed. The second thing is, and this goes to the statutory interpretation argument, the shortness of the length, the 15 days, strikes me that that's an argument that the legislature intended that this section be directory and not mandatory, because if we're going to interpret it as you want, 15 days, they're out. And that, in many instances, could simply be impossible to fulfill.
These sorts of time limits are not impossible to fulfill, and in fact, in mental illness cases, commitment for mental illness under Chapter 51, we have really the same type of time period. They are strictly enforced by the courts. The courts are aware that the cases will be dismissed under Lockman if the time limits are not held to. In this particular case, my client can't be said to have any control over what was happening. After all, I mean, he was eventually found to be not competent, and then he was treated to be competent. If a criminal defendant in a competency proceeding cannot waive a preliminary hearing when he's alleged to be incompetent, then certainly my client in this case cannot be said to have given up any rights or failed to exercise certain rights. It is my contention that this type of individual is a very vulnerable individual and needs to be protected by the courts. I think that under the competency statute itself, that it shows that it's the court's responsibility to make sure that the defendant is transported to and from the institution within a reasonable amount of time. That appears in subsection D, right under the subsection that's in question in this case. So I feel that while dismissal is a drastic remedy, it's going to prevent long stays and warehousing of individuals the way this individual was warehoused. And I think you'll find that there will be few, if any, cases that will be dismissed in the future. Because when the courts and when the court personnel are aware of the sanctions involved, then things are certainly challenged properly, and that's been my experience.
Well, in this case, there was an order from the bench, right?
I'm sorry, I'm having a hard time hearing
you. That's okay, I'm having a hard time talking. So we're so even. The order was from the bench, right?
Was from the bench, and it was not reduced to writing, that is true.
So if it had been reduced to writing, what would have happened with the order? Would it have been sent to the jail?
Well, who knows? I think...
Well, what's generally done?
I think that each case in competency tends to be handled a different way, depending on the judge, depending on the defense attorney, depending on the prosecutor. Honestly, I think that in one county, competency cases can tend to be handled different ways.
But counsel... they may be handled different ways, but does a sheriff ever transport without a written order?
I don't think so, no. I think that the system, perhaps involving everyone involved, owed my client a responsibility to get that done, and it wasn't done.
Because in reality, I mean, it seems to me, in reality, the fact that it wasn't reduced to writing means that there will be no follow-through with transporting for an examination.
Yes, but the fact is, in this case, it was the order was made, was not reduced to writing. And I don't think that this case is here to assess percentages of blame on individuals involved. I think it is here to see if the courts owe a responsibility of due process and perhaps speedy trial to make sure that these vulnerable individuals are adequately protected and handled in the right way.
The Chief Justice asked you what the ordinary procedure was. What happened first time, first order for competency?
In the first order of competency in December, there was a written order that was entered. It's not entirely clear who drafted it. It was a type of order that placed the treatment in the hands of the department. It was in that other section in which the time limit is triggered differently. And that was one reason it was included in the material, to show the difference, included in the appendix. As to exactly who drafted it and who made the arrangements for the transportation and who passed the information on, I can't tell you. I can tell you that in our county, our clerk is very active in informing the department, the sheriff's department, and other appropriate individuals that the fact that an order has been entered. So it is quite possible that the fact that the order was not entered in this case had a lot to do with the delay in time. But my client's argument here today is that, in fact, the delay in time did occur, and it occurred without due process, and I don't think we need to go farther than that.
Well, tell me what is contrary to due process here. What is your due process argument? Now, one argument might be there's a statute. And if when you don't follow a statute, you have violated due process because you have not given the person the process due that the state says is due. And here it wasn't followed. Okay.
I think the argument in this case is that the statute actually codifies constitutional law. That was spoken about, I think, really for the first time in the Jackson versus Indiana case. In Jackson versus Indiana, talks about warehousing individuals for undue periods of time, and that to do that is a deprivation of due process.
So I see that liberty is deprived without giving people prompt hearings. That's a violation of due process.
Yes, nothing was scheduled. Apparently no action was being taken to schedule anything. No arrangements were being made to treat the individual. The case was not on any kind of calendar to put it to trial or to anything else, apparently, for a long time. And in 5 months is extraordinary in this situation. And also, because of the subsequent findings that have been made concerning the mental status of the individual, we see that, in fact, the treatment was successful. And then he, in fact, was released on a signature bond, pending decision in this court.
Now, in Jackson v. Indiana, was the remedy that was dismissed with prejudice? Is that the remedy that Jackson v. Indiana...
Jackson versus Indiana did not mandate a remedy, but Jackson, Indiana, and this is very interesting to me, speaks of speedy trial as a possible remedy. Now, I see Jackson as a due process case, and Jackson speaks basically of due process. Yet at the end of the Jackson case, and also in the Haskins case in Wisconsin, the remedy is at least at times spoken of as a speedy trial remedy, which would be dismissal with prejudice, in the appropriate situation. Now, I believe the statute came about mainly because of the Jackson and Haskins case. And there is wording in Haskins that I can even refer to where the court says that the legislature has to deal with a number of these problems. They talked about where do we dismiss with prejudice in these competency situations? What kind of guidance do we have? We have the Jackson case telling us what we have to follow. We have these constitutional mandates from Jackson versus Indiana, but in exactly which situations do we dismiss? And they give the legislature a signal saying that the legislature should be establishing time periods. And in fact, then that is what happened. And that's why I think the bottom line on this statute is that it has a constitutional base, and the legislative history shows that it is founded in the due process and speedy trial, and in fact, equal protection arguments of Jackson and of Haskins. equal protection being that in the Haskins case, there were many references made to Chapter 51 procedure. There were the references made to the Lessard case, which was still in the middle of litigation. And there was a speculation that the Equal Protection Clause would be forcing this state to adopt the same types of protections for those involved in competency proceedings as resulted from the Lessard case. And I believe that is, in fact, what happened. And as I said in my brief, the 15-day time period for the examination is quite close to that initial 14-day time period in 5120 in mental commitment.
What if we bought your first argument that the language of the statute is mandatory? And so then the legislature takes up the subject next session. How can they make a law that is directory and that still is consistent with the Constitution?
Well, I'm sure that the legislature could repeal the statute and enact one that is specifically directory. Then there may be a question.
So a directory statute would be okay?
Well, I'm not sure that I would personally agree with it, but if there was one enacted, there certainly could be situations where that statute would be violated and the statute would not require dismissal.
However, what if the statute simply said the state shall make every effort to hold the competency hearing within 15 days?
The constitutional...
If it fails to do so, it shall hold in a reasonable time.
Yeah, right, good.
Within a reasonable time. Well, then I guess...
Within a reasonable time thereafter.
Constitutional...
And no dismissal for this cause. That's what you want.
Yeah.
And no dismissal.
Right.
Saying no dismissal allowed? Well, that would be infringing upon the constitutional power of the courts. I would think that statute would be void.
Harmless error.
The court can say, the statute can say it's harmless error. What we're trying to do is get a statute that would not make it jurisdictional of the court to even if there isn't a timely hearing.
If there was not a hearing like in this case,
right.
which would occur 5 months of warehousing, as
right.
I call it, and there was a statute that said the time was only directory, and there was no remedy of dismissal with prejudice allowed, the courts would clearly still have the power to dismiss the case on the basis of due process and speedy trial.
What if they hold it within 20 days?
If they don't do it within 20 days on the directory statute?
Yeah. No, if they do it the 20th day.
If they do it on the 20th day?
Yeah.
If there's not a statute that is mandatory, then it's a question for the courts on whether it's constitutional or not.
Well, suppose in this case, with a statute of 15 days, they did it in 20. They told it, you can make it worse, they did it in 16.
Where the statute is directory.
This statute, this very statute, let's just change
the
back to the case.
Just
say, not 5 months, but it was 20 days.
Mm-hmm.
So they're late. And you come in and say, statute says 15, they didn't do it in 15, dismiss. I mean, that's what you're asking us now. The only difference in the two cases is
yes.
Time.
Yes, I understand. I think that just like in the Lockman situation, if you are outside of the 14 days in Lockman, and the mandatory statute has been violated, it must be dismissed. And I think the way this is seen is that the legislature has created a time period in order to enforce the due process guidelines.
Why not treat this the same way? Or what would be the problem of treating this the same way as a preliminary examination?
Well, I think it might be the same if the client had been in custody the entire time. I know there is case law about preliminary hearings saying that it's not necessarily a constitutional violation, where there are violations of the time limits in the hearings for preliminary hearings. But I think there would be a big difference in the court's ruling if there was a long detention in jail without having a preliminary hearing. If there was a felony in which a preliminary hearing was not held for 5 months, I think there is quite a good chance that the case could be dismissed for constitutional speedy trial reasons.
Counsel, I'm sorry. Please. Counsel, why does the dismissal have to be with prejudice?
I believe that the dismissal has to be with prejudice in order to safeguard the rights of the individual.
Was it with prejudice in Lachman?
Yes. In Lachman, it was held that the court was not competent to proceed with jurisdiction. The BJA...
So had to dismiss the petition, but why couldn't the petition be refiled?
It could not be refiled because the intent of the legislature, apparently, is to enforce the statute as a constitutional guideline and to prevent the abuse of holding the individual longer. And I believe the case of BJN, for instance, which the state actually cited in its brief, Chief Justice Heffernan carefully explained how a court can lose its competency in subject matter jurisdiction and very carefully defined those terms, which resulted in mandatory statutes.
I think of in Chapter 51, for instance, a allegedly incompetent person can waive the time limits. The time limits say 14 days, but they can waive the time limits up until, I think, maybe a 90-day period.
I think under the McCredden case, it's clear that someone who is alleged to be incompetent is not capable of waiving any such right.
I'm not familiar with that case, but the statute says 51.20 sub 8 BG, the subject individual or the individual's legal counsel with the individual's consent may waive the time periods. This is for a Chapter 51 proceeding. For the probable cause hearing or the final hearing or both for a period not to exceed 90 days from the date of the waiver.
Well, it's interesting that in a Chapter 51 case, a client can be alleged to be mentally ill, but can still be competent to proceed. I've always wondered, can the question of competency be raised in a Chapter 51 proceeding? I've heard of it done once, but that's all. And so you clearly can have, and I clearly stipulate with clients accused in 51 cases where I feel that they are competent to do so. So just because one is accused of being mentally ill does not mean that he's not competent.
I've just done a quick read of Lachman, but I wasn't sure that the dismissal was with prejudice. It was clearly a dismissal, but
it could be that the word prejudice wasn't used, but the words competency, I believe, were used.
Yes, the court was without jurisdiction.
Yes.
That's right, on that petition. So you dismiss the petition and another one can be refiled.
Well, the way I read the law with BJN and Lachman and other cases that deal with so-called mandatory statutes, they talk about it being a harsh remedy. I don't think it's such a harsh remedy if it's without prejudice.
Mr. Getson, why isn't the availability of monetary damages a civil lawsuit a sufficient remedy in this case?
Number one, because the courts owe a responsibility to this group of defendants and all defendants to properly enforce the laws. Secondly, I think that such individuals generally tend to be poor and are probably not likely to obtain attorneys to pursue that remedy. And it's really a different issue altogether. I think the issue in this case is the responsibility of the court system to provide for hearings within a reasonable amount of time and make sure that people are not warehoused in the jails and not just leave it to the civil courts to see what might happen.
Well, don't you think if Marathon County had a large judgment rendered against it or some of its officials that the message would be well learned?
Well, I suppose, but the possibility of that happening, I would speculate, is not very great.
What were the charges here?
There were four underlying cases commencing at different times. There was a drunk driving case. There was a felony battery case. There was a police battery case. There was also a child support case. And the drunk driving went back as far as 94, and actually the client was brought in on a warrant relating to that case. And all those cases are still unresolved.
This is a petition for habeas corpus?
This is before this court on a petition for habeas corpus. It originally went to the Court of Appeals on an interlocutory appeal, a petition for leave to appeal, and the petition was drafted to treat it in the alternative as a petition for habeas corpus. And therefore, the order denying That petition made this case reviewable by this court at this stage.
Is Mr. Hager still in custody?
Mr. Hager is out on a signature bond.
Further questions? Okay, counsel, thank you. We have 5 minutes for rebuttal. Representing the state is Assistant Attorney General Sally Wellman.
Thank you, and may it please the court. I'm having a little difficulty talking today, too, but I'll try very hard to make myself heard. The state in no way takes lightly what happened in this case. Mr. Hager should not have sat in jail for 5 months with no progress on his case. We take that seriously. The question, however, is what the legal consequences of that apparently joint error should be. It is our position that the competency statute time limits are not mandatory, that the legislature did not intend release of the incompetent person and dismissal of the underlying criminal charges, either with or without prejudice. Moreover, it's our position that his detention in custody for 5 months, he was could have been released if he had made bond, but he did not make bond, that detention is not a denial of due process under a Jackson or Lessard theory, and that there has not been proof of a violation of a speedy trial in this case. So there is no constitutional violation here, and therefore no constitutional remedy is available to Mr. Hager. To go to the statutory construction question first, I think it's important that this court remember what it said in interest of R.E., which was a case involving an MGI committee who did not have a timely reexamination hearing. This court made it very clear that when it construes a statute to be directory, it is not saying that the statutory time limit is permissive or discretionary. When you say it's directory, you're saying that we find that the legislature did not intend the person to be released and the action to be dismissed. That doesn't mean that we are encouraging anyone to ignore the statutory time limit. It's still a right that the defendant could have brought at any time in this process, or his lawyer, and said, I'm entitled to my evaluation, and he could have gotten a writ of mandamus.
Well, but suppose it's not done. It falls through the cracks again. Suppose every day he says, I want out, and I'm supposed to get an examination, and it doesn't happen. Suppose a writ's brought to the court, and by the time it all finishes out, it's another 5 or 6 months. But what are the remedies, the real remedies in the real world?
Well, the real remedy in the real world is that you get a determination of your competency examination as soon as the error comes to the court's attention. That's what the court said in R.E. The court still has an obligation to do what's supposed to be done as quickly as possible, and that did happen here once it was brought. Apparently, it's not clear exactly how it came to be that counsel suddenly realized his client had been sitting in jail and had not gone for his competency evaluation, but once he did, he brought it back to the court, and reasonably promptly he was evaluated and there was a competency hearing. That's the real remedy here. True, it doesn't give him his days back. We cannot give him his days back. They're gone. That's regrettable, but nothing this court does can give him those days or months back.
Is the state liable? Or is the county liable for money damages for liberty?
I don't know. I'm not familiar enough with civil damages practice. I think that if there were no constitutional, we would say not under constitutional theory because there's no constitutional violation either way. It's possible that for a pure statutory violation, if it rendered his detention illegal, he would have a cause of action. But against the trial court and the prosecutor, I think judicial and prosecutorial immunity might apply. It's possible he would have a claim of damages against his defense counsel. I simply don't know. But I think the real relief here This is rare. I think that's important, too. There's no indication in this case that there's a systematic problem that this court needs to address. As far as we can tell, anyway, this individual case slipped through the cracks, but not because the court doesn't have any system for, you know, managing incompetent people. My impression is from the first hearing, or from the first order in December, is that an order gets prepared, and maybe by defense counsel, the court may do it itself. It gets transported to the sheriff's department, and the sheriff then takes the person to the institution if it's going to be an in-house examination. We don't know exactly who all dropped the balls here.
If this is so rare, then no one need be concerned about the floodgates opening up, right? I mean, if this is such an isolated case, then we can just address this fact-specific rare case.
I'm not sure I'm understanding your question. I'm sorry.
Okay. A concern sometimes arises about the ramifications of rulings. You're suggesting, hey, there's not much ramification in the system to any ruling that we do in this case. It's very fact-specific because it's so rare.
What I'm suggesting is that this court need not reach out to create a cure for a widespread problem when the cure doesn't exist. It certainly can use strong language, as it did in RE, to say even a directory time limit is directory. It means courts and court personnel and lawyers need to pay attention to it and obey it, and I think that message will come through loud and clear. What would be, I think, a bad ramification of a decision is to suggest that the statute is mandatory and that that means that he's entitled to dismissal with prejudice under either some kind of a statutory construction argument or a constitutional argument. The only other places under a constitutional theory that I am aware of where you get dismissal with prejudice, in essence, is double jeopardy, where the harm itself is retrying the person. You cannot retry the person if there's a true violation, and a speedy trial violation.
Well, I think the brunt, if I may, because I think it's a good question. If, in fact, this is such a rare case, then why not say that it's mandatory because it's hardly going to have any impact, if any?
I think it's a rare case that a person is going to sit in jail for 5 months without any progress on either his criminal case or the competency proceeding. I don't know if it's rare that a time limit is missed by one day. If a report comes in on the 16th or the 20th day instead of the 15th day, if you say the statutory time limit is mandatory, and by that you mean the legislature intended the person to have to be released and the criminal charges dismissed with prejudice, that's going to apply if the time limit is missed by one day. It's going to apply if the crime is first-degree murder or horrendous torture, rape, a child sexual assault.
But can't we cure that by saying that the dismissal is not with prejudice?
It would be a less drastic remedy. But if the concern here is one, I still think you have the statutory construction problem, but I don't find any indication that the legislature intended that, and that's what this is all about. Nonetheless, it seems to me that if the concern here is that, as Mr. Getson is claiming, that overburdened court systems, overworked prosecutors and defense counsel, when that happens, things slip through the cracks. It seems to me that by mandating a dismissal where the charges will be refiled, there'll be a new initial appearance, a new competency evaluation, or you're just duplicating effort. You're just adding to a congested system. That doesn't seem like a remedy that's necessary in this case.
Why is the statute to be interpreted different from the preliminary examination statute?
Well, as far as I know, the preliminary examination statute, I don't know of any case that has interpreted to say that the legislature intended the person to be released and the charges to be dismissed. And while I'm on that, I thank you. I would like to bring to your attention an error in my brief. At footnote 1 on page 4, I indicate that when the time limits for a prelim are not met, I say that the remedy is release of the person but not dismissal and certainly not dismissal with prejudice. That's incorrect. I meant to say the case law says that it's release of the person and dismissal, but not dismissal with prejudice, and I apologize for that.
Didn't the court, though, devise that as the way to enforce the statute?
Well, the early cases say that the trial court loses both subject matter jurisdiction and personal jurisdiction. Now, that was many, many years ago. We now know from more current cases like State versus Mack and others that the court does not lose subject matter jurisdiction. Criminal courts have subject matter jurisdiction as a matter of the Constitution. Loss of personal jurisdiction, it seems to me, is a legal fiction. And it's the same kind of legal fiction that was around for a long time regarding illegal arrest. For many years, this court said if an arrest was illegal, the trial court did not have personal jurisdiction. And you overruled that in State versus Smith. That's at 131 West 2nd. Recognizing that what you're really getting at with an illegal arrest is a violation of the constitutional Fourth Amendment right, and we take care of that by suppressing evidence. So I think this court could clean that up in this case and get loss of jurisdiction and loss of competency to proceed out of this analysis. It doesn't add anything, and all you're really saying is a straight statutory construction argument. Did the legislature intend that when this time limit or other provision in a statute to be mandatory, and if so, what is the relief? One of the reasons I think the whole competency thing is confusing, at least it confuses me, is that in other areas where you found statutes mandatory, such as in interest of EB, where it said the court shall give the instructions to the jury in writing, and in Kawanda F, where the statute says the trial court shall inform the juvenile of her right to judicial substitution, this court did not talk at all. It found those statutes mandatory, but it didn't talk at all about, well, because the court didn't do something that was mandatory, and that ran directly to the court, not to some other person. It didn't talk in terms of loss of competency to exercise jurisdiction. It said we still look at whether it's reversible error, whether it's harmless error. And it seems to me that that's inconsistent with a theory that says whenever a court doesn't obey a mandatory statute, there's a loss of competency to proceed. But I think the clean analysis and the correct analysis is simply the statutory construction one. And under that, there are a couple of reasons why this case is different from the Chapter 51 case. I'm sorry, did you want to...
If you don't find the statute to be mandatory, how long can someone go? I mean, how do you enforce the statute if there's nothing, if there's no enforcement mechanism?
Well, I think the enforcement is that, one, that we ordinarily expect that people will follow through and do the correct thing. And here, as soon as it was brought to the court's attention, it was corrected. So... the other remedy, if you had a situation for whatever reason...
I want to just follow up. We have a 5-month time period. Suppose it was 3 years. Now, it's been there 3 years, all of a sudden they find him, and we have a dismissal with prejudice. What are you going to say then?
At some point, the time period may be such that the incompetent defendant has a claim that his speedy trial right was denied. And that's really what Haskins was about. In Haskins, they said, even when the person is found incompetent and therefore cannot go to trial, it wasn't that the statute wasn't followed, but he was incompetent and he might be incompetent for many, many years. That doesn't automatically mean, by virtue of the fact that he can't go to trial for many, many years, that doesn't automatically mean his speedy trial right was violated. What it means is you kick into and do the speedy trial analysis. Now, Mr. Hager has not claimed a violation of speedy trial right, but if he were to, there's an analysis in Barker versus Wingo and Hatcher and Green and the state cases we discuss in which you would look at the length of the delay, and while 5 months is regrettable, frankly, in comparison to speedy trial cases, it's not very long. We've had lots of speedy trial cases of over a year. But you look at the length of delay, you look at the reason for delay, And if there is no intent by the state, no intent to do harm to the defendant, no intent to cause this delay, then it weighs against the state, because the state as the government is ultimately responsible, but it doesn't weigh very heavily. Thirdly, you look at prejudice. One aspect of prejudice is confinement, when you could have been released, but the most important aspect of prejudice is prejudice to the right to present your defense. And absent a showing of wrongdoing by the state, an extremely lengthy delay, and actual prejudice in the sense of his right to defend against the charges ultimately was prejudiced, it's rare to get a speedy trial ruling. In particular, because you have to evaluate prejudice in terms of what effect did it have on the trial. Did somebody die so he couldn't present his defense or his witnesses? We have to wait until after trial to evaluate that. I don't know of any case where a speedy trial, a finding of a constitutional right, a violation of the speedy trial right has been found pre-trial.
So now your analysis, except in this case, should we, in the decision, require judges to make written orders for incompetency hearing rather than as happened here? This is obviously why they slipped through, because it was just an oral statement.
I agree, and I don't know that you need... I don't know that you need to require that, because I think normally it happens. Normally, the person who asks for the relief, defense counsel, asks for prepares the order. Sometimes the trial court does itself. The first order here, the December 16th of 96 order, to me reads like maybe the court or the court staff wrote it, because at the end it says, copies shall be delivered to defense counsel and the district attorney. I don't think we need to always burden trial courts with that if counsel normally can do it. You know, if there's a pervasive problem throughout the state and the court would have some reason to be aware of that we're not aware of, you know, that might be appropriate. But it seems to me that normally it happens because it's in the interest of every party to have it happen. It's in the interest of the state to move things along, too. If the defendant were not incompetent and were simply malingering, the state wants this cleared up promptly, too. So it's not as if anybody is intentionally getting anything out of delaying these proceedings.
One of the arguments Mr. Getson makes, and made an oral argument here today, is that this is one of the most vulnerable of classifications. That is, oftentimes, criminals are looked upon in a negative way, and oftentimes, what they do is a very, very negative response to this individual. And then you have a negative response to an individual who is incompetent and not able to assert any rights. There is something, I think, rather persuasive about this is the most vulnerable of the people that we see in the court system in some way. And when you have greater vulnerability, perhaps that necessitates the court to make sure that there is a safeguard for protection. Could you respond to the vulnerability argument? Does that play any part in this case?
Well, I think there are many criminal defendants who are mentally ill and therefore vulnerable, even though they may not be incompetent to stand trial. And I think that because we do have poor, uneducated, possibly mentally ill to one level or another defendants in the system, we primarily protect that through defense counsel.
My experience is that there's a lot of mental illness, but when you're dealing with the competency to proceed, you're often dealing with the most minimum of the minimal. And
that may be, however, Mr. Getson has, in the court papers filed, he indicates that it's his client who made him aware that he had sat in jail for 5 months. He said, when he first told me, this was at one of the hearings that's in this appendix, when he first told me, I thought, that can't be, there's something wrong here, and then I checked it out. So it appears that the client had some understanding that this had occurred and brought it to his attention. Why it was not brought to first counsel's attention promptly, I don't know. I don't know if the counsel never went and saw him or what happened. But regardless of that, I think that the ultimate question for this court and the public is the same. Is the remedy such that we should dismiss the criminal charges, and in particular dismiss them with prejudice? which means that this person will never stand trial for these charges, that the public's right to have the criminal laws enforced will never be vindicated, that any victims harmed will never have any redress in the court's criminal system. And it seems to me that however you characterize who all was at fault here, where the cracks in the system occur, where the person fell through the cracks, even if you look at it as we'll lay the blame at the feet of defense counsel, it seems to me that you would still have to have a finding of prejudice in the sense of prejudice of his ability to ultimately defend against the charges, which there's no indication of at this point. And the remedy for that is not dismissal with prejudice. Dismissal with prejudice is not the remedy, even when there's intentional wrongdoing. If the police intentionally go in and dressed in a three-piece suit and with a briefcase and tell the guy in the jail cell, hey, I'm your lawyer, and get a confession out of him, that is egregious.
Well,
but we don't dismiss with prejudice.
Mr. Getson responded, perhaps not in these words, but in his comments to a question, suggesting that unless it is with prejudice, it's a mockery. And there's some resonance to that. In other words, you can just have the order for dismissal in one hand and the order for arrest in the other hand, and you have one tenth of a second of liberty. I mean, that does seem a bit of a mockery if you're talking about, sure, you can dismiss it. You know, that's the remedy, dismiss it. Well, you know, that's a remedy without any meaning then, isn't it?
Well, I don't think it's a remedy without any meaning, but it certainly, hopefully, the prosecutor and the court would not want to have to go through doing things twice. But I think it's a remedy that's not warranted by the statute. It's not dissimilar, though, from the speedy trial, from the cases where a defendant is in custody for a long time pending trial. He claims a denial of the right to speedy trial. The court says, no, you haven't shown enough to show a speedy trial violation. There's no speedy trial violation here. He gets no other remedy. Even if there were some delays that should not have occurred. So I think that in light of the legislature's intent, in light of the fact that here we have serious criminal charges, some of them involving violence. We have criminal charges, we have a criminal process going on, and to say that when there is a delay in an ancillary proceeding, the competency proceeding, that the remedy, no matter the harm of the remedy of dismissal with prejudice, far outweighs, I think, the harm that occurred here.
Let me just... The policy argument that the other concern, having also sat on the trial bench, is that it's a question of public safety also. I mean, if these people are not dangerous to the public and they're in there for really serious crime, I guess that is one of the things that I think I, as a trial judge, would be looking at when they made the motion to dismiss and release this person into the public.
I think the policy argument is part and parcel of the statutory construction argument, but you're right. I think this court should find it unlikely that the legislature intended those results of dismissal or dismissal with prejudice in light of the serious harm. This is very similar to In Interest of RRE, in which this court said, no, the statutory time limit is only directory, but that doesn't mean that we don't care and we don't want to enforce it. There's mechanisms to enforce it, and if it gave a very clear message to trial courts that we expect you to hold these hearings promptly and we don't expect to see a succession of this kind of delay. In this situation, a little bit ironically, I guess, even if if this had not occurred and the defendant had had his evaluation in 14 days, say on July 17th, a written order was entered, it went to the sheriff's department, the sheriff got him over to Winnebago on July 18th, the evaluators got their report done by July 20th, and there is then no time limit for when the trial court has to hold the actual hearing. So there still could be some delay. It only says that the court shall send the reports to counsel forthwith. I mean, it's sort of like the reasonableness example that was being used before. And the remedy in our system, there are many situations where there aren't tight time limits. We expect things to be done within a reasonable period of time.
Well, Ms. Wellman, as I look at this statute, the problem I have with your case, I look at the statute as a whole, subsection C. And it seems to me that what the legislature is doing here is saying, look, you got to give these people a competency exam within 15 days. But we recognize that bad things can happen to good people. So if, in fact, you can't get this thing done in 15 days for good cause, we'll give you another shot. But we'll only give you one shot. They don't say the court may allow another 15-day extension. It says the court may allow one 15-day extension. Now, it seems to me that that argues very much for a mandatory construction. You've got 15 days. We'll give you one shot if you for whatever good cause you screw up, but only one, and then something bad's going to happen. How would you answer that?
I think it does indicate that the legislature wanted these evaluations to be done relatively promptly, whether that's 15 or 30 days. But I don't think it means that we can draw the inference that if it does not occur, the legislature wanted this potentially dangerous, mentally unstable person released, and in particular, released and never able to come to trial again.
Just to follow up, let's assume that there is good cause shown with a hypothetical defendant, and then the state fails to adhere to the 15-day one extension. Then the case comes to us, and the argument is the defendant should be released without prejudice. I mean, how could the legislature be clear? You've got one 15-day extension, and that's it.
I think the legislature can be clear by saying if the hearing, the evaluation is not timely filed, either originally or on extension, the defendant shall be released and the charges shall be dismissed with prejudice. If that's what they want, then that's what they should say. I'd like to, if I can, and unless there's more, I'd like to very briefly just turn to the Jackson analysis. Go ahead.
I have a question about page 29 of your brief. You say here, of course, Jackson and Haskins were not violated because petitioner was not detained in a mental health institution beyond the time necessary to determine if he was incompetent to permit him to regain competency. So, suppose this guy had been put into a mental health institution, and then he was warehoused there, and nobody did anything for him. And 5 months passed. What would happen then?
I would argue that we still use the same analysis, that the legislature didn't intend it to be mandatory and didn't
What about Jackson?
Under Jackson, I still say this is not a Jackson violation. What Jackson held was unconstitutional was the kind of statute that was prevalent at the time of Jackson, where once the person was found incompetent, they could be held in a mental institution forever if they never regained competency or until the maximum sentence for the charge of his life sentence, 50 years, that's how long they could be held, without ever having the procedures that other involuntary committees get, and without there ever being a formal determination of dangerousness. If you'll recall, Mr. Jackson was a deaf mute who had stolen a purse and stolen some money from a purse, and he'd been held for over 3 years and probably would have been held for the rest of his life because he probably would never become competent. And the court said if you're going to hold a person in a mental institution forever or for a long, long, long time, you have to give them the kind of procedures and make the kinds of findings that are required for involuntary commitments. And that's what Jackson is about. Jackson didn't deal with any preliminary time limits. In particular, Jackson also said, we are not going to say that the criminal charges have to be dismissed if the person never is going to regain competency. And in fact, our competency statute now provides that the criminal charges can just stay open in case the person regains competency. If he regains competency, he's going to go to trial. 5 years has passed, he says, my speedy trial rights have been violated, and he can make that showing. Then he might have a speedy trial violation. But the being held in the institution without any process, as if it were a permanent involuntary commitment itself, is really what Jackson is about. The Chapter 51 cases, Lockman and NN, which do go on a statutory construction analysis, I also think are distinguishable because they're the sole basis for the state's holding this person at all, for the state interfering with this person's life and liberty at all, is the mental health commitment. Here we have the underlying criminal charges. If his commitment had never come up, he could have been in jail or held on bail, you know, subject to bail restrictions regardless. And now, that's different.
I see Chapter 51 as an analogy. You're part of your interpretation of statutory construction, and you said this. The legislature could not have meant for potentially dangerous, mentally ill persons to be essentially released because of a violation of a short time. Well, that's exactly what happens in Chapter 51. There's a probable cause hearing to determine that the person is, number one, mentally ill, and number two, is a danger to self or others. There's a court determination of dangerousness and mental illness. And yet the law is clear. If that hearing isn't held within 14 days, the case is dismissed.
The law is also clear, however, that the petition can be refiled. And although Lockman may not spell that out, other cases that in fact are cited in defendant's reply brief makes it clear. You get it dismissed and the state immediately can file the same petition.
Well, but your underpinning of your legislative interpretation is the legislature could not have intended a mentally ill, potentially dangerous person to really be released because a 14-day short violation was, and that's exactly what the statute says in Chapter 51, and that's exactly what the cases say. You got a mentally ill, dangerous person, you blew the 14 days, and it's dismissed.
If I may, I have two quick responses to that. One is, those are Court of Appeals cases. This court has never reviewed the Chapter 51 holdings of that statutory construction, and I don't believe that's the correct statutory construction either. But more importantly, it seems to me it's a big leap from that to say the legislature intended the underlying criminal charges to be dismissed, which is the alternate basis for holding the person and interfering with his custody.
Are there any other questions? Thank you, Ms. Wellman.
Thank you.
Mr. Getson.
Thank you. I draw the court's attention to a recent case that discusses constitutional underpinnings to a statute which would require mandatory dismissal, and that would be the Kiwanda F case, K-Y-W-A-N-D-A. It's cited in the respondent's brief. It's a 1996 case, and I think it's made clear again in that particular case that if the legislative history shows that the reason for the statute was based on constitutional reasons, that the statute should be interpreted as mandatory. So this idea of competence and losing subject matter jurisdiction relating to mandatory enforcement of a statute is not something that's gone away.
Counsel, I'd like you to address that last exchange between Justice Bradley and Ms. Wellman. As I understand that exchange, Ms. Wellman's response was, well, in a Chapter 51 proceeding, even though you can dismiss, you can have in that other hand a recharge.
That's not my understanding, but I certainly can't point to the cases that were referred to as saying that
What's your understanding?
My understanding is that if a Chapter 51 petition is dismissed, that if a subsequent petition is brought, it's going to have to be based on other circumstances. Certainly another Chapter 51 petition may be brought for that individual, but my understanding has always been, as a matter of practice anyway, that the new petition would have to be based on new allegations.
New grounds.
Yes.
So he or she would have to present this dangerousness again. I'm talking about...
There would have to be other acts that occurred after that, yes. Which, you know, normally there can be in those situations, of course. But my understanding of what a mandatory statute is all about is a matter of enforcement of rights to protect people in the future in those situations. The idea is not to encourage the courts to release people that may be mentally ill and dangerous, of course. The reason is to stop the courts from holding these people for inordinate periods of time. And that would be the reason for a ruling in this case. Is to mandate that they be short periods of time. And I believe that the law shows that's what the legislature intended. Jackson, of course, did not talk about this initial period of examination. Jackson was a broader case than that. But at 5 months without any kind of hearing or process, in this case, wasn't warehousing, I don't know what it was. But then the Wisconsin case of Haskins interprets Jackson and carries it through and basically tells the legislature, look, we're in a situation where we probably should be providing the same kinds of rights that now exist in Chapter 51 cases due to the Lessard case.
I don't want to be too far afield with the example, but it seems to me, in just thinking, if you had a quadruple homicide and the person goes in for a mental
Your answer is, and he is threatened or whatever, the answer is basically a dismissal, and then what happens?
Well, if it's a mandatory statute and is dismissal, it must be with prejudice, but I think you could count in that situation that it's not going to happen, that the statutes are going to be violated because the court system is going to pay attention.
That's what I'm asking about, that extreme situation.
For instance, in my first argument, I mentioned my experience is with Chapter 51 cases that if one segment of the court system isn't on the case to get it scheduled, that another is. The clerks, judicial assistants, judges, corporation counsel, they are on the case because they're aware of the strict sanction involved.
Did you give any thought to bringing one of your claims as incompetent counsel?
No, because I don't think it has anything to do with this case. Ineffective assistance may be brought at the end of a case. The criminal cases have not been processed. The purpose of this particular case is to free my clients and establish the law of the mandatory statute. And of course, if it was that, I would not be able to do that.
Well, I'm just wondering if an attorney is appointed to represent a defendant and then abandons him for 5 months, that to me is not competency on his part.
Well, I can't speak to the facts of that. But I think that we are here to speak to as to what the court system did. And I believe that the statute also speaks to the court's responsibility. Thank you very much.
Thank you, counsel. That ends our argument in State Ex Rel Hager versus Gary Martin. The court is in recess until tomorrow morning at 9:15.